to the VanCast for this week, and this is going to be a fantastic show because Bruce Boudreau of the Vancouver Canucks is going to join us. We've got so much playoff hockey to talk about as we've already started getting teams into the conference finals. The Battle of Florida didn't necessarily deliver. The Battle of Alberta is absolutely delivering. We'll get into that as well, but looking forward to talking to Bruce because it's been long overdue, Drancer.
Yeah, and we'll talk a lot about the playoffs and some of the trends that he's observed, particularly because, you know, tactics and analytics have become such a constant flow of conversation around him. I'm looking forward to the chat. Bruce is always good people.
Yeah, he absolutely is. But before we get there, let's talk a bit about some of these other games. And, you know, I've now got skin in the game because I really didn't care who won the Battle of Alberta, but now I am all about the Calgary Flames.
I mean, I just think it's amazing, an amazing accomplishment that the Edmonton Oilers managed to win a cup in 10 games. I've never seen that before. It's an NHL record.
Well, for sure it is. And I'm trying to know what Thomas Dranz feels like in the Vancouver market and take all the arrows.
I saw that. You pulled a Drancer on the city of Edmonton.
I did, yeah. And, you know, and here's how it started. It started with Eric Francis, who after the game, you know, wrote an article that basically said, look, say what you want about Jacob Markstrom. Say what you want about taking too many penalties and Draisaitl and whoever, Kane doing well. This is all about Connor McDavid. And then my good friend Dustin Nielsen from TSN 1260 in Edmonton said, three forwards played more than McDavid. If the Flames think just one guy is beating them, they actually don't understand what's happening here. And I'm all about Eric's take. I am 100% in that corner. So I responded, and I was a little strong, but I responded with that one guy, meaning McDavid, is everything. The rest are nobodies without him. He gets into everyone's head. He's the complete focus of everyone's attention and makes everyone around him better by merely existing. He might be the best player ever. Without him, the Oilers aren't a playoff team. And you can imagine how Edmonton reacted. Actually, I'm not sure you could, because I don't think Vancouver to you has ever reacted that way. So,
but I'm inside. You know, at the end of the day, I'm still a Vancouverite.
Sure.
You know, like the only people that get really mad at me think I'm from Toronto.
For sure. That happened to me because I had a bunch of people here saying, well, you're basically making the case for McDavid winning the MVP. And I said, yes, I am. He should be the MVP. Now,
no, look, he shouldn't.
I was a little strong. Like if I had a do-over, I would have added two words into my tweet. I would have said 29 aside, the rest are nobodies. Okay? Because certainly you can't call Leon Draisaitl a nobody. So if I could walk
I'm not here. I'm not here for the slander of Vancouver Giants great Brett Kulak, but sure.
Okay. So so for me, I would walk it back a small amount because you can't say Draisaitl's a nobody. So, you know, mea culpa, that's fair if you're upset. And most of the fans were kind of hanging on that line.
About semantics? Come on.
But the reality is that Draisaitl is not McDavid. And I don't care that Draisaitl has won a Hart Trophy, or that he's a two-time 50-goal scorer, or that he won his Hart because of 20 games he played with McDavid injured and on the shelf. Because today's Connor McDavid, what we are seeing right now in the playoffs, Draisaitl is not in that league. And we've had, you know, I got all this stuff about everybody's got their player like that. No, they don't.
Nope.
No, they don't. Because
there's
we're
only
talking
one
about,
of these. There's only one variety of this guy.
Yeah, and
he's, you know, a unicorn. Like,
when you talk about generational player, I had one person tweet at me, well, you know, you go through the draft and you wait for your generational player. Excuse me. Generational players are Rocket Richard, Bobby Orr, Wayne Gretzky, Sidney Crosby, maybe Ovechkin, certainly Mario Lemieux, and Connor McDavid. Right? Like, that's what a generational player is. A generational player isn't a good player. It isn't necessarily a Hart Trophy winner. Henrik Sedin won a Hart Trophy. He's not a generational player. Heck, he's a debate for the Hall of Fame. So
no, he's not.
What Connor McDavid is doing,
he's not a debate for the Hall of Fame. That's ridiculous.
Okay, but you know, but okay, so fair. He's not a debate for the Hall of Fame, but you can't call Henrik, and we love him, you can't call him a generational player.
No, right? And I never have.
So please do not say Leon Draisaitl compares to today's Connor McDavid, because that's fiction. And I'm still not backing off from the idea that if you don't have Connor McDavid, that team doesn't make the playoffs. And coming into this series, everybody outside of Edmonton picked Calgary. Why? Because they're the more complete team. It hasn't shown. But Everybody, and even people in Edmonton, were concerned about their blue line. They were concerned about their goaltending. All of it. Right up until the end of game one. And now all of a sudden, all that's changed. And I'm like the ugly non-Edmontonian. Because I've got this tired old take about McDavid carrying the team. McDavid is carrying the team.
Well, yeah. Okay. So let me adjust my glasses, right? Let me adjust my glasses and take a, you know, big hit off my inhaler. And I will also hit my suspenders against my chest and remove all fun from the equation. With Connor McDavid on the ice at 5-on-5, and he's played 43 minutes. Only Evander Kane among Edmonton Oilers have played more. The Oilers have outscored the Calgary Flames 10-4. 10-4. In all other minutes, the Flames have outscored the Oilers 6-2. There you go. What else do you need to know?
Well, yeah. And
there's McDavid minutes. There's McDavid minutes. And there's everything else. And in everything else, the Flames are outscoring the Oilers 3-1. Now, to remove even more fun from the equation, the Oilers have 35-on-5 shots with McDavid on the ice, and they have scored 10 5-on-5 goals. That's a 33% shooting clip with McDavid on the ice 5-on-5. Markstrom, for me, is the biggest, like, McDavid's the biggest story in this series because we're seeing the best player in the world go up a level. But this is being enabled in large part because Markstrom is not playing Markstrom hockey, in my view.
Agreed.
I mean, you go through the 5-on-5 data, and it's like, you know, the Oilers have been outshot by almost 20, right? The Calgary Flames have a 58% share of expected goals. You know, they've got 18 more scoring chances at even strength. They've got 21 more scoring chances at 5-on-5. Like, even though McDavid minutes are different, the Flames are still the better team here, except for the fact that McDavid is destroying Flames goaltending. And that's why it's 2-1, which, by the way, is hardly over, right? Like, hardly over.
But they better get both of those things figured out, because
they need Markstrom. The thing is, they need Markstrom to play like Markstrom. Period.
Yeah, and
if he's actually tired, they're kind of cooked.
And as much as McDavid is in the Flames' heads, so is Markstrom, right? Like, they're wondering what the hell's going on behind us here, right?
Yeah,
and that is no part question of it. But again, I should not have said Dreisaitl's a nobody, but McDavid is carrying that team. Let's be clear. And, you know, people are still pissy about the draft pick situation. Well, like, yeah, there's a reason. Like, and, you know, for me, like, I'm past it. And I'm past it because I want to enjoy and appreciate the best player in the world. You know what I mean? But there are certainly people that are, because I felt as a kid I didn't enjoy Gretzky because, you know, as a kid, I cheered for the Canucks and, you know, so you hated Edmonton and you hated Gretzky. And I didn't really appreciate Gretzky till he got to LA. So I missed out a lot. So I don't want to miss out and not appreciate McDavid now. However, right, like, the notion that Edmonton did this right in terms of how they acquired him is fantasy, right? Because there was no plan. This is not like a team deciding to, you know, weaponize cap space and to, you know, intentionally take on bad contracts in exchange for young assets, but know they're going to need to be bad for a while. You know, there was no plan. Like, from 2010 to 2016, there was no plan, right? It was just throwing darts at the dartboard, being historically horrific, getting 5 first overall picks.
Oodles of draft lottery luck.
Yeah. And draft lottery luck. And in the middle of that, when you didn't get the first overall pick, you also got Dreisaitl. You know, and to the point where the NHL had to change its rules. So that's why people may still be sour or still carrying that narrative. Now, for me,
And let's not forget, too, there are big time Montreal Canadiens vibes coming off of this Edmonton Oilers team. Now, their success is going to be more durable because they have Connor McDavid.
For sure.
But make no mistake, the opportunity cost that came with their offseason upgrades are mammoth. And a variety of their improvements, even the improvements that are paying off right now. I think about the Zach Hyman deal, the Duncan Keith deal, on and on. Those are deals that will expire in terms of their net positive value to the club very quickly. The club had a real chance to carve out $30 million in cap space and set themselves up for a 5 or 10 year window of contention. Instead, they made a bunch of short-sighted moves. They may look like they're paying off now, but the bill comes due. The bill comes due when you build that way. And regardless of how far the Oilers can take this, and honestly, at this point, I mean, I like to witness greatness. So I'd love to see McDavid continue to just throttle everybody for weeks on end. It's a lot of fun to watch.
I can't say they won't be Colorado. Like the level he's playing at, this is not a normal part of any equation.
I still don't think they're beating Calgary. So
there you go. But again, I appreciated getting the Drancher treatment from the Toronto fan base, from the Edmonton fan base.
The Edmonton fan base, yeah.
And it's funny because I just scrolled through so much of it. Like, I probably looked at about, one out of every 10. And you know me, right? Like, I don't respond to idiots. I mute idiots. I just respond to measured people, right? So there you go. That was fun.
You're a better man than I.
That was fun. And listen, before we get to Bruce, I know you really want to talk about the Battle of Florida, because that really wasn't much of a battle.
No, and Andre Vasilevsky is incredible. I mean, that was a historic performance from him to end it in four. And, the Panthers, I think the lesson here for Canucks fans is every bet the Panthers placed once Bill Zito came into the fold paid off, right? For Hagee, DeClaire, like everything they touched turned to gold. And even with all of that, an elite supporting cast built, like all of the things that went right for the Panthers, a rebuilt blue line that was more than the sum of its parts, and on down the line, you still get to a point where you bump into an elite team in the playoffs. You still get to that point. And in Florida's case, that means a second round sweep and a very West Coast Express era vibe to how this season unfolded. And it's not good enough, but they shouldn't overreact. You just have to keep going. You just have to keep charging forward with what you believe in intact, just like the Tampa Bay Lightning did in constructing this own, dynasty. A team that's now playing for history, by the way, right? I mean, we're now at a point where the Lightning are 8 games away from being remembered as one of the great teams ever, right? Islanders, Oilers of the 80s, Habs of the 70s, like that's the company that the Tampa Bay Lightning can join if they win 8 more games, which is also, I like to witness greatness. I'd love to see that. That would be a hell of a storyline. So it's going to be a fun couple of weeks here as the NHL gets down to brass tacks. And, in the Panthers' case, I think, especially for Canucks fans, I think the lesson here is, boy, oh boy, is it tough to win, right? It is so hard to win. Everything can go your way, and you can still get swept in the second round by an elite team. That's just how difficult the task ahead is. And Vancouver is years, years away from being a team as good as Florida.
Yeah, no question. It was just, I don't want to say it was tough to watch. I'm sure it was tougher for you having been a part of that organization, but I was shocked that it ended as quickly as it did, because I think we did have some doubts, minor doubts, small D doubts, about Tampa's ability to defend given some of the players that they'd lost last offseason. And it showed at earlier points, especially in that first series having to go to 7 games, again, against a very good Leaf team, but nonetheless, it does create doubt on what could come up later down the road, especially against an even better team like Florida. And for them to dismiss them summarily the way they did was impressive. And, we thought the 2011 Canucks were an elite team. Wow, that tells you just how tough it is. Meanwhile, on the 11-year anniversary of Kevin Bieksa's double overtime goal against the San Jose Sharks to propel the Canucks to the Stanley Cup Finals, we talk to the newest coach of the Vancouver Canucks when the VanCast returns.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, at this time, it is our pleasure to welcome the head coach of the Vancouver Canucks, the still head coach of the Vancouver Canucks for the upcoming season, Bruce Boudreau. Bruce, you've been a lot of fun since you got to this market. We've enjoyed covering you. Thanks so much for doing this with us today.
No, it's my pleasure. I sort of miss talking Vancouver Canucks hockey and miss talking hockey altogether, quite frankly.
Well, we've heard you on all these other podcasts. We felt bad that you haven't been on with us. You've been on with the league. You've been on with all these other guys. So let's talk a little bit about the Canucks. But before we get there, just your return. And I know that there was a lot of angst in the market because, you know, you were wildly popular, as I said, when you first got here, that there was going to be a point where maybe you weren't going to be back next year. I mean, how serious were you contemplating other options, or did you always know you were going to be back in Vancouver for the coming year?
There was no other options. I'm going to make this perfectly clear. I don't know how many times I've said it, but I wasn't thinking other options at all. I mean, first of all, I'm under contract. I couldn't talk to anybody, but that's here nor there. I had to do two things. And one, you have to realize that when I got there, it was like game 7 for me, I think, for the rest of the year. And so I had to decompress for a little bit to think that I want to do this again. And, but more than that is my wife made 10 different trips, to and from Vancouver. And we have a junior team back there that, I mean, we've made a pretty good commitment, as to wanting to make it go in Hershey. So we had to get everything settled that if we were going to do this again, that we had to make sure our sponsors were in place, our coaches were in place, that everything was in place before we could commit. And then probably the most important thing was I had to, I went to Toronto and I visited my mom. She's 90 years old. And I wanted to know if she was okay. I'm her only relative. And to be that far away from her, if she was going to be okay with it. And she ended up giving me her blessing. And once she gave me her blessing, then I came home. It was on a Wednesday. I was driving home and I talked to Jim and I said, I'll give you my answer very soon. And I went home, talked to my wife, and we told them on Friday morning that I'm coming back. I always wanted to come back. I mean, the biggest thing was always, you know, you hate to do a job and you think you did good and the team did well, but you're still not in the playoffs. And at that time, you're watching 4 games every night and you're getting pissed off, quite frankly, that you're not there. So I wanted to, you know, it was always really important for if we started something to see if we could finish it. And that was my argument to my wife and my mom. And so they bought it. And so I'm coming back.
Well, all pretty good reasons for taking your time. But I also want to ask you, before we dive into some of the details around roster and coaching and things like that, just the reaction that you got from players and from fans, you know, the Bruce There It Is stuff, all of it. Did you expect any of that when it first came to pass and you were the coach of the Canucks?
No. You know, that was probably the furthest thing from my mind. I was happier than anything to get back into the game because I missed it so much. But, I mean, I never once thought about it. And when they started doing the chant, and that's when, like, as you guys know, I said, oh, geez, I hate this thing. Like, I mean, I don't want it to be about me. By the end of the year, when they were chanting, it means we were having success. So it was sort of like, if they were chanting, it means we must be doing something good. So then the way I think, I said that then it's a good thing. But I mean, I never thought that, you know, that they would react that way or the players would react that way. But it was, it really was fun. And it was, you know, I mean, it's humbling when people are doing that. So I just hope they get to do it a lot again next year.
Bruce, it was sort of a European soccer thing. I mean, we don't usually see in an NHL arena the fans chanting a coach's name. Did you get any feedback about it from the players, from your peers? Like, what do people just sort of, when you text them, reply like, oh, there it is? Like, how much do you hear about it?
You know, I didn't hear much unless one of the players or you know, what the players would do and even the coaches, In the text, it would be always the text, Bruce, there it is. And like, I mean, it was almost like the tagline. And I went, oh, okay, you know, so, but I mean, you just get used to it. I mean, I'd go into a couple restaurants and they'd start chanting it. And I'd go, okay, lighten up here, people. I didn't want that, but no, I'd never experienced anything like that. I knew that there was arenas that I'd coached before that I was popular, but not to this extent. And like I said, it was overwhelming. It's humbling. It's like, but I'm also smart enough to know that it's only as good as we win. If we don't win, you ain't going to hear it. It's going to be, Bruce, there you go. Bruce, there you go. So I don't want to hear that one.
Well, you did a lot of winning, obviously, once you came on board. But changes have still been made to your coaching staff. And I just want to get a chance to hear you sort of debrief on Scott Walker's departure and what he meant to you over the course of this year. And also, you know, ask you, should we expect that you'll add still a couple of bodies just in terms of an eye in the sky and a video coach, even, you know, in the wake of some of the changes behind the bench that were announced over the weekend?
Well, I could speak to Scott first. And the whole plan when I had asked Scott in the first place was he was going to do it for the year. And that was his commitment, was for the year. And I understood it. And I said, great. And I thought he did a great job. But he has an awful lot of commitments at home, and he's a real family man. And I mean, he owns, you know, still part of the Guelph Storm, where he's really big part of it. And so I totally understood that his situation when he said, you know, he didn't think he could come back. And as much as I would have loved him back, but I knew it from the start. And it was sort of like sitting there going, you could hope, but I knew what the answer was going to be. So, I mean, a little disappointed, but we knew it from the start. Everybody knew from the start that his commitment was for this year.
So what about next year for you? I mean, are you looking for another coach, maybe for up top in the press box, another video coach? And if so, what are you looking for?
Well, right now, I mean, I'm pretty happy with, you know, what we've got, quite frankly. Jason did a really good job on the power play. I mean, if you look at our numbers, and Brad did a really good job with the defense and the penalty killing. So, I mean, a lot of teams just have that. And I mean, if management and I, we have meetings all the time, decide that we need one or two more guys, then we will go out and get them two more guys. But right now it would be, our decision together type thing. I think it's pretty well self-assured that we're going to be looking for a video coach, because every team has a video coach at this point. But as far as anybody else goes, that's we haven't talked about it too much. I'm sure we'll be talking about it, but I'm happy if we don't. And if they decide to do something, then I'm happy as well.
How much of a difference do you think the coaching last year made once you arrived, as far as the special teams were concerned, because it was such a problem earlier?
Well, I mean, I don't know why there was a problem. There's some great athletes on our team, and I can only speak for when I got there. I mean, I think one of the things was consistency. I think both, unless there was injuries, both penalty killing and power play, we used the same guys going out the same time. I mean, you could write it on the wall that, you know, JT was going out first, Horvat and Pedersen were going out second, Lamico and Dickinson were going out third, and then we'd repeat. And then the same on the power play, as you had your top five guys or the same five guys, and we practiced it a lot. I mean, we practiced the power play a lot, which meant the penalty killing was getting practiced, but it was power play what we were really working on. But and Brad did a really good job of relaying. First, Scott did a really good job, and then he got sick, and then Brad took over and he did a really good job. And then when Scott came back, he said, no, we're doing really good. Let's keep things the way they are. So that was how that went. But I think the consistency of it and just the athletes themselves, I made it go really well. I mean, I couldn't understand why it didn't go well before, because, like I said, they're good at what they did. Oh, Tyler Mott was always the first one to go on with JT. So, I mean, that's the guy I forgot when I was first talking about it. So, and then I think you add that on the penalty killing, Pedersen, started killing penalties and Quinn Hughes started killing penalties. So now all of a sudden we had skill out there as well. And every time it got on Quinn's stick, it was down the ice. You didn't have the turnovers where you're seeing, okay, you get the puck and you watch it in the playoffs and it happens all the time. You get the puck and you don't clear it. Invariably, it ends up in your net. So, I mean, he did a great job of getting the puck out. And Petey did a great job of anticipation. He's not a shot blocker, neither is Quinn. But their anticipation and their quickness to get on pucks, I think, really helped a lot. And we became a little bit, even though we didn't do it a lot, we became a threat to score from the defensive, from the penalty killing situation, rather than just defending and letting other teams set up and do the thing. I think the biggest change penalty killing is we became way more aggressive. I mean, when I was watching it when I was at home, it seemed like the retrievals the other team was getting, and you give a team a minute in the zone and the skill in the NHL now, they're going to eventually score. And I think that's what worked in our behalf on the power play too. We became more aggressive of getting it back to the, getting it and starting with that triangle offense up top. And it worked really well because we had four guys that really knew what they were doing up there.
Bruce, you've worked with a lot of assistants over the years, and some of your most frequent assistants are now head coaches. Obviously I'm thinking about Dean Evason, but you come into a situation in Vancouver where I don't know if you had a pre-existing relationship with either Brad or Jason. I mean, aside from Scott, how do you adapt, I suppose, to working with new assistants and sort of building that familiarity, and what worked over the course of your first few months with the Canucks?
Well, I think we had an awful lot of meetings for one thing. And you're right. I mean, I came into it and I didn't know Brad. His son had played with, for my son in the East Coast League, and we'd met a couple times to say hello and that, but that was it. Jason, I didn't know. Gus, I didn't know. Kyle Gustafson, and I didn't know Daryl. But I mean, you have a lot of meetings, and you spend time with each other. You get to meet them, and I think the first thing that I came in and I said, listen, I want to spread it around a little bit, but at the same time, the players have got to get to know me because I knew none of the players either. So I have to be the voice right now. But the more meetings we have, and I think all of them realize that, I mean, their input was important to me. And if they said something that really made sense, whether it was Scott or any of the other guys, that we took it and we ran with it. Because I mean, I'm not the brightest bulb in the tree a lot of times, and guys have great ideas and we use those great ideas. And so, I mean, they really helped a lot, especially too, as well as letting me know what the players were like initially, because I didn't know them. I mean, I got to know them pretty quickly because I do have a lot of individual meetings, and I tend to come into the dressing room and I want to talk to all the guys, at least say good morning and see how they're doing, how their families are. And I think it's important for me to show that I care about them if I want them to care about me and the team. So, I mean, that's just what my modus operandi has been like my whole life. So, I mean, that continued. But, I mean, it was always, I think the biggest thing is we had a lot of meetings. We got to know each other a little bit. They got to know where I stand. I mean, it wasn't all peaches and cream. I mean, there was a lot of good arguments going in there and a lot of disagreements, but in the end, I think we all got on the same page.
I want to ask you about Brad in particular, Brad Shaw, because it did seem like once you took over that, you know, there were more drills that he'd run. He seemed more involved just to watch from out the outside during practice. What can you tell us about how your relationship evolved and how much you came to lean on him over the course of the year?
Well, I mean, he would run. I told him very quickly that, I mean, if we're doing a defensive drill, something that from the blue line in, I want you to run it. And it's the same because I wanted the defense to get his voice on what was happening all the time. So, I mean, that's why he ran things. Plus, we would sit around and we would discuss. I, for example, in the morning, said, okay, we need a good warm-up drill. Who's got it? And if somebody came up with the idea of what the drill was, I'd let them run that drill. because far be it from me not knowing the drill, then they should run it. Now, Brad took the bull by the horns on most of them, and he wanted to do it, so I let him run with it. I think next year we will have more versatility in that all the coaches. I mean, Jason was a little shy, but he ran all the power play. Anything that had to do with power play, he was running it. And Scott would be beside me talking about what's going right, what's going wrong, and all of those sort of things. I mean, we will have, I've always done it in whether it's be Minnesota, Anaheim, or Washington. I mean, we want everybody to run the drills. We want everybody to, we want all the players to hear the coach's voice and to understand that the respect that they have to have for them, because I mean, they're doing the drills. And it's amazing how the coaches, when they don't run drills often, they take everything so personal and they want it perfect. So their work ethic at that was really good.
Bruce, I want to take you back a little bit to the end of the season and the end of the year availabilities for Patrick Alvin and Jim Rutherford. And certainly the topic of structure and zone exits and things like that came up. And you kind of took the conversation at that point into analytics. And I'm not sure that that's necessarily how it was intended, but that was something that you wanted to clarify. How do you incorporate that into your coaching and what you want to do going forward? How comfortable are you in that world?
Well, I mean, I'm obviously, when I first started, there wasn't a lot of analytics going on. And a lot of people did it.
Well, Drencher wasn't even born yet.
Ouch. well, he might have been born, but I tell you, he probably had hair.
Yeah.
So that's the pot calling the kettle black, by the way. Anyway, you know what? I think I love analytics. To me, is just a continuation of statistics. And I was a big, huge statistic guy. Growing up, I knew all the stats. I mean, if a player on my team wanted to know anything about anything in the league, they would ask me, well, what's this guy got? What's that guy got? And I seem to know it and I pay attention to it. What I also pay attention to was a lot was my seeing the game and going over the game. And usually with analytics, for the most part, I would look at the game and watch the game and then read the analytics and see if that meant said the same thing as what I saw. And more times than not that it did. But I mean, I didn't pay a lot of attention on the numbers, quite frankly, like especially in Minnesota when it said, okay, you had 48 entries and you had this X amount didn't go right or didn't success. And I thought 48 entries, that's an awful lot to keep track of. I would much prefer to keep track of how many turnovers. And that's the words I would use is turnovers. I mean, and exits in the same thing, but I'm really going to ask Aiden. I want to sit down with him and I want to get the definitions of it. Cause what I'm watching all the games now, especially after that, after the press conference and looking at all the exits and seeing how teams exit, but still not wondering what is a controlled exit and what is, an exit of getting it out. And I'll get to that, obviously, very soon, as soon as I get back to Vancouver and meet with everybody. But I mean, I really, really want to find out the true answer. So analytics are really good. And analytics, Corsi's line against line, like, I mean, is especially when we used to use that a lot in Minnesota. And I'd sit there and I'd go, man, this line can't check against that line. And then I'd look after the game and find out I was right, you know, or I was wrong. And so you keep that in your mind, you write it in the book, and then the next game you try something different. So, I mean, that's but analytics are great. I think we can overuse them. There's still a lot of hockey that I'm watching and I can tell whether we're playing good or we're playing bad and what we have to do to succeed. And sometimes you know that you're deficient in some areas and you got to overcome it by playing in a different way. But that different way may mean the analytics aren't going to be good, but you're going to win because you're playing differently than what it has to be. If you don't have that much, if you don't have a tremendous amount of skill in one position, all of a sudden you might just have to get the puck and ring it off the boards and hope it gets out, or it, you know, or bring it and get it deep and try the forecheck that way. So it's a little skewed sometimes. It's the same way as high danger chances. And when you think about it, if you've got Ovechkin taking a shot in the slot and from the high slot, for example, that's an A1 chance. And at the same time, if Nick Patan was taking the same thing, he's getting the same mark, that it's just a high danger chance, but it's, you know, we'd much rather allow him to take those shots than we would an OV type thing.
And you
that makes sense.
It does. And you talked about it at the time when you were first asked about it, that look, my focus is winning games. And sometimes that might not mesh with the analytics. But how difficult was it for you at that time to hear the criticism about just what the team looked like?
Well, I mean, you know, everybody takes a lot of pride in, and nobody likes, I don't care what business you're in, nobody likes to get criticized. But everybody, you know, your bosses have rights to do whatever they want to do. And if they want to criticize, I mean, some people shy away from it and cower. Like if I was a player and the coach would criticize me, I would certainly sit there, oh yeah, I'm going to show you. So that's the way it, my mind works. So that's what I'm going to be doing. I'm going to look at it and I'm going to correct whatever was wrong in their minds, and we'll go from there.
Bruce, the analytics topic is an interesting one as it pertains to you specifically, because frankly, going back about a decade, the underlying data has been extremely high on your impact on teams. Like within the community that's tracked this the most closely, you know, it's probably you and Daryl, ironically, who are like the patron saints of controlling play 5-on-5, to sort of find yourself on... Are you even aware of that? Do you even know sort of that would be how you are generally regarded by people that pay attention to the numbers?
No, I have no idea how they regard me.
Extremely favorably, which is why... You know, I'm not willing to have a conversation in this market anyway, where the idea of Bruce versus analytics is even pondered. Like, you're the guy who controls play 5-on-5.
I know we tend to. I know in Minnesota, when I had one of the meetings that, and Alex Mandricki, who's now in Seattle, she was our analytics person. She said, Bruce, do you realize, he says, you're the number one team in the league to allow the fewest high danger chances. And unfortunately, you're 31st in save percentage. So, but I knew that one for sure. And once I, you know, when Alex told me that, it really was important for me to continue playing in the D zone and defensively like that. Like, I mean, I wanted to make sure, okay, that says we're doing the right thing. So, you know, if we get the right people, we're going to have success. And I think this year was proven correctly that we do do the things correctly in our zone and back checking and or tracking, whatever the new vernacular is this day. And we want to continue that. And so it, when you do it properly and you've got good goaltending, and then you can rely on these things and you know you're going to eventually have success. It's a proven formula. And so I don't want to stop at that formula because I know it works. And with Daryl, I know exactly what he does. I've been coaching against him for 15 years and I played with him for 3. So, I mean, I know, and his thing works too. I mean, exactly. I mean, you look at all his teams. I mean, they're built the same way when they're doing good and they have success all the time.
We've brought up a couple of things, or specifically you've brought up a couple of things that I think are interesting because we're seeing them play out in the playoffs. You talk about the more aggressive PK and we're seeing teams that are extremely high pressure on the PK have a lot of success in that area. I mean, they didn't win the series, but I think about that first Toronto-Tampa game. I think about the way that Carolina's played throughout this playoffs. And the other thing we're seeing, and you discussed it too, on the zone exits, is we're seeing teams just break out repeatedly with like 4 or 5 quick, short area passes. to sort of key that breakout. What other trends are you noticing in the playoffs that have just caught your eye as someone who knows this game as intimately as you do?
Well, I mean, the one thing I've noticed in almost every series is that the controlled forecheck, everybody's pulling out and making it almost like a half-court game in basketball. Whereas I've always been really aggressive and have everybody tight in almost like a man-on-man situation, because my philosophy has always been, why do we let them have free entry into our zone? But if you watch it, like, I mean, Tampa's playing the 1-3-1, but it's a really deep 1-3-1. And I mean, their F1, is, not to get too technical, is at the red line. Their three forwards are other three at the blue line, and their other guy is so deep. So if you try to dump it in on them, it's almost impossible. The other thing that I've really noticed is you can tell how important playoffs are, because the commitment to blocking shots is incredible, and especially on Tampa. And I remember when Tortorella won the cup with Tampa in 2007 or no, whatever, 2004. I think that was the biggest thing that everybody came out of it, is they blocked everything. They blocked everything. And when he went to the Rangers, he couldn't get that same kind of commitment, even though he wanted it. And it was difficult. But you look at the guys, when I see Corey Perry diving in front of shots, it just goes to show me that how many hockey players care about winning the cup. And that makes it so much more difficult to win, but it makes you want to win it so much more.
How impressive is what Tampa's doing right now? I mean, you just knock off the President's Trophy champions in a sweep. You know, they've made a lot of changes to that team, and for them to be back in the conference final here again for the third straight year, how impressive is it to you?
They're such an impressive team. Their leadership must be incredible, because they get everybody to play exactly the way that they have to play to win the cup. And let's not forget, we talked about goaltending a little bit, and you don't win anything unless you have a tremendous goaltender. And what is in the last, seven closeout games, Vasilevsky's had five or six shutouts and allowed one goal in the other game. I mean, that to me is an outstanding number. I thought St. Louis would have given Colorado a really good run, and they still may. But I mean, as soon as they lost Binnington, all of a sudden it seems like the confidence has shifted more in Colorado's case. I don't think St. Louis can win it in Colorado, even though I give them, I love their team. I mean, they've got so much heart, but I think Colorado's going to beat them. So it's goaltending is quite a thing.
Well, and in the Battle of Alberta as well, I know coming into the series, everybody expected Calgary was going to have a big advantage, and Markstrom hasn't necessarily played to the way we're used to during the season. But more impressively for me in that series is Connor McDavid, who is the best player on the planet, has taken his game up to yet another level. How impressive is what he's doing?
It's amazing. I mean, you just watch, and every little thing, almost every shift he does something, whether it's a little thing or whatever. You can hear the crowd almost lifting out of their seats every time he touches the puck. And you could see the desire that he wants to win. And sometimes those great players, they get that look in their eye, and it's hard to stop them. And when you're the best and you're averaging 3 points a game, I mean, the way I look at it, then the rest of your team only has to get one other goal, and you have to play good defense, and you're going to succeed. And that's pretty well what they're doing.
I want to come back to the point you made about Tampa's deep 1-3-1, because they've played a couple of opponents that were probably faster than them, and it kind of didn't matter. Is there anything you can take from that, particularly because we did see this Canucks team, the roster as it's built, we saw it play extraordinarily well. We know that the goaltending's there. We know that the defense was there last season, and we know that they can score. But it did seem like faster teams occasionally gave your club some issues. Is there anything you can take from the success that some teams have had installing a more half-court feel?
Well, I mean, it's it's an interesting thing. I mean, and you know, if you look at Tampa, when they have Perry and Maroon, and I had both of them, and neither one of them could skate a lick, but they're being very effective in that format, and you know, I mean, they understand that in Tampa, and so that they're doing what all good coaches do, is they're playing to what their personnel is. I mean, when Montreal was great, it was all about speed, you know, in the 70s, and Islanders were big and strong, and they have tendencies to you have tendency to look at the Stanley Cup champion and want to build your team the way they are, but it changes every couple of years. I mean, we would love to be faster, so we can't skate faster on our team. I mean, we have who we have. There, some guys weren't overly quick, but what you can do is you can play faster, and the puck always moves past faster than the skating. So I think if you noticed that with our team anyway, that we started moving the puck quicker and getting it up quicker, and that's how we ended up playing faster and getting the puck deeper and trying to equalize the speed that we didn't have to the speed of the play, which we could improve as much as, you know, getting open and getting pucks up, forwards getting pucks deep, and then just getting in on the forecheck.
Yeah, well, one of our catchphrases on this podcast, Bruce, and you sort of alluded to it in an earlier answer about exits in particular, is punt and hunt. The idea of pushing the battle just into the neutral zone and trusting your forwards to sort of reverse it. It did seem like one of the big changes that was installed when you came in was in that area. It just felt like a little bit more high flippy, a little bit more glassing out, and it seemed to work in terms of propelling your forward group out of the defensive zone more quickly, but obviously not always with control, and that's now become a talking point.
That's the question. If you get the puck out, okay, like say you watch Carolina tonight and they were the best exit team in the league, now that I've done my research and I've watched them pretty watched them pretty close. As soon as the puck comes in, all they do is rim it out, get it out as fast as they can, and their forwards race to the puck. But it's out of the zone. And I mean, I found out early enough that and watched our team that if we played around with it in our zone, we usually ended up making a bad pass, and it would end up causing more time in our zone than we really wanted. So, I mean, it was, let's get this puck. If it comes into our zone, it's like, that's where we don't want it. Let's get it out of this zone as quick as possible. Now, if we can get it out of this zone under control with one good pass, that's what you want to do. But if the bottom line is we're being pressured and you just have to get it in and get it out and then have a good, strong neutral zone, then that's what we wanted to do. And that's why I think we were in the top five defensively in the last 56 games.
So based on how you would like to play, what do you think this team's biggest needs are? And I know that's a delicate question to ask, given that you don't make those decisions.
I don't make those decisions. So the stock answer is anybody they get, I will make into a better player. That's what my goal is. But how would you like to play is you would love to play with speed, and you'd love to score on the rushes and get the pretty goals. But in the end, what usually happens is hockey hasn't changed that much in 50 years that I've been close to being around it, is you win battles, you shoot the puck, you play to the inside, and you win those, because most goals are scored within 5 feet of the blue paint anyway. So, I mean, it's getting in there and having the will and the want to get it. I mean, those are the things. But I mean, in a perfect world, we've got Quinn Hughes, but I also like to have Cale Makar. Sure. But I like to have Nathan MacKinnon. I mean, and that depth of talent that a team like Colorado has. Yeah. But I mean, you have who you have. I love the guys that we have. I think we've got a great group of our core players are as good as anybody's. And I look, quite frankly, at the Rangers and how 3 years ago or so they said we're going into this whole rebuild and everything. And then they got Shesterkin, so they got the goalie. They got the defenseman and Adam Fox. They got Panarin. And all of a sudden they started building around all of this stuff. and they became a great team that, you know, it's going to be tough for them to beat the Rangers, I think, but or beat the Carolina, but they're now put in the same category as that. So we've got those same things. We got the great goaltender. We got the great defenseman. I don't think there's another team in the league that has three better centers than we do. If you look at Miller, Pettersson, and Horvat, and you can use one of them on the wing if you wanted to, but I think the makings of the team is right there. The foundation is really strong, and we just have to build on it.
So how do you as a coach, going into the final year of your contract, and also not being a spring chicken, right? I mean, how do you approach the long view? Because, you know, the organization might decide to take a step backwards in order to take more steps forward and maybe part company with those guys and maybe want to groom younger players and things like that. How do you balance that with where you're at?
Well, it's a tough call, to be honest, and it's a great question. I mean, I want to win. You're right. I'm no spring chicken. I think I act an awful lot younger than I look.
You do. I'll give you that.
You know, and thank God I don't have to do a lot of skating in practice, because as you've seen, my skating has deteriorated a little bit. But, in a perfect world, you would want the best team that you can put on the ice all the time. But I also have always understood the organizational needs. And no matter what team I've been on, whether it's worked out or hasn't worked out, I always think of the organization first. So if they think it's better to do this, I will take that and run with it. And I think I'm confident enough that I'll always, will be competitive if that's the case. I don't think that's the case. I think we play to win every time, and I think we'll play to win every game next year.
Is it healthy, do you think, Bruce, to have a situation where a coach is focused on that? Just grind out the 2 points and obviously take some account of the organization's priorities, but really just be focused on grinding out 2 points while management takes a different view in terms of what the club's long-term needs are?
Well, I think the coach's job is to win. I mean, that's my job. I look around the league and how many good teams and good coaches have been let go this year because of winning. They can focus. The management focuses on the overall health of the team and the organization. My job is to somewhat do that and bring young players along and develop guys if I have to develop them. But my job is to win. And every game we go out, I want the players to believe, and I think we got them doing that, is to believe that it didn't matter who we were playing, we can win the game. And I think you're so far ahead of the game if you step on the ice and you think you can win. I look at Tampa, and I know every time they step on the ice, they think they can win the game. I know Colorado feels the same way. And, it's when you have that feeling, then you're never behind. Florida had it during the regular season. They never thought they were going to lose. And so they had all those comeback wins. We did the same thing when I was in Washington in the early 2010 era, that no matter how far you got behind, if you believed you were going to win, you could do it. Now, it's not a healthy situation sometimes if you don't come into the game and you don't play a 60-minute game. And this is what happened to Florida. They always thought they could come back, and then they play a great team in the playoffs and they can't come back. But I mean, it's a good situation to always think that you can win.
And one last one from us, and I want to thank you so much for your time today, Bruce. Farhan and I have been having a running argument over the course of the playoffs, and I'm curious to get your take on this. Farhan believes that if you make the playoffs, anything can happen.
Except win the cup.
And I believe that that's true in a single game or a single series, but that to win 16 games, to have elite results over 25 games, the 25 you need, I think only great teams can do it. I don't ultimately think that any team that makes the playoffs really has a chance. I think there's 7 or 8 elite teams every year that have a chance to win, and one of them usually does it. What's your take?
My take is you're probably right 90%, 98% of the time. But there's what makes sports great in any sport and in sports history is when that one team does come up that Cinderella team, then they're talked about forever. I mean, example, I don't think anybody thought that the Carolina Hurricanes were going to win the Cup in 2007. And they just kept winning and winning. And were they good enough? No, at the time, nobody thought. But if you look 2 years later, all the good players they had on their team, yeah, you go, yeah, well, they were really good. But that doesn't happen. And I think you can win a series. Look at the Montreal Canadiens proved it against Washington. But, I mean, to win 16 games like that, to get the goalie to play that good for 16 games, it's impossible. Anaheim tried it in 2006, I think, or 4. Jagr was unbelievable until he met 03 when he met Detroit or New Jersey, one of those two teams, and he couldn't do it for 16. He did it for 12, but that was an incredible run. But I mean, to do it for 16 games, that is history making. If you can do it for 16 games, and I don't think it happens too often. Usually the cream rises to the top and the best teams usually win in the end. In one series, anything can happen. In 4 series in the NHL, it doesn't happen too often.
Bruce, thanks so much for doing this. Hopefully you can be around here long enough to make some history with the Vancouver Canucks. But until then, we know we're going to enjoy spending some time with you and doing the press conferences before and after the games. You're always a lot of fun. Thanks for this.
Well, I appreciate it. And hopefully I am around long enough to see us finish what we started and have really good success.
You know, Drancer, you and I are both fans of Travis Green as a coach, and we got along with him off air because, you know, we knew how dismissive he could be on air, but he was actually a pretty good guy. But it's a completely different vibe covering Bruce, and I know both of us just get a chuckle out of the guy daily.
He's good people. We're lucky to cover hockey, right? I mean, there's a lot of good people in this game, Bruce among them. And look, I thought it was a really interesting chat. We kept it pretty technical, right? This wasn't asking about individual players. We weren't after the sound bites. I sort of was trying to get a sense of how he's viewing some of these games in the playoffs, what he's seeing in terms of, you know, tactics, particularly since some of his have been front of mind in terms of what we've talked about and what management has talked about in this market of late. You know, the fact that Punt and Hunt became a talking point in the wake of this season remains to me one of the funniest things we've ever seen. Like, I can't believe that what was our watchword, Farhan, has become like a relevant, controversial matter for debate.
I like Vancouver High Flippy right now. Better.
High Flippy, yeah.
High Flippy's a better one for me.
Yeah, I like High Flippy too. But
for me, though, it is ironic, and you pointed it out, that for a guy that probably has minimal interest or just use for analytics, I mean, I think he respects it, but he doesn't necessarily process it all. The fact that analytically he scores really highly, I think it's ironic and it's interesting.
It's that it comes down to pressure, right? Boudreaux's teams typically take an aggressive route to good defensive results, right? By taking away time and space, they, you know, end up limiting what teams are able to generate against them. It's just that they do it in a way that feels high tempo, but the results aren't always high tempo. I thought that Rod Brind'Amour gave a great quote on faceoffs today that I think really like ties a nice bow on some of the counterintuitive things that we, you know, struggle with in hockey. And he said about faceoffs, he said, they all matter and they all don't. And that's exactly right, right? It's like anything can happen in a game, but anything can't happen over 25 games, right? The cream rises, as Bruce said. You know, being aggressive results sometimes in better defensive outcomes. And it's just a fascinatingly, like the game of hockey is just so fascinating in how cruel and variable it is. And because of its habit of taking the least predictable or sensical path to a logical conclusion. Like, that's what I love so much about the game itself. And, you know, I thought a lot of Bruce's comments and certainly a lot of his, work over the years, point to that.
Well, it was great having him on, and hopefully we'll do it again at some point before the season starts. But as for us, we're going to wrap this one up. It's been long, but certainly worthwhile. And if you're looking for other pod options, Lightning writer Joe Smith joined Sean Gentile and Julian McKenzie on this week's The Athletic Hockey Show. Also, Bill Guerin joins Michael Russo on Straight from the Source this week at The Athletic. And hey, thanks for listening to the VanCast, or watching in this case, as we had Bruce on with us. Please follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Don't forget to leave a rating and a review. Right now, you can get an annual subscription to The Athletic for just $1 a month for 6 months when you visit theathletic.com/VanCast. The next time we have Bruce on, I think I'm going to wear like a skull cap so that I can just kind of be with the bald kids group.
Well, especially because you found 4 different ways to call them old.
I said, you're no spring chicken. Nothing wrong with that.
I was like, oh, Farhan.
Come on. Bruce and I were tight like that. Hey, as for us, we're going to return on Wednesday, I think. Or sorry, not Wednesday, Thursday. And for Bruce Boudreau, for Drancer, and Farhan, thanks for logging on.